First of all, I want to thank, thank you on behalf of New College for the for the plug. Obviously, I think liberal arts education is hugely valuable, and I'm very much a supporter of that tradition, which is important here and is important throughout the United States. Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here in New Paltz to speak with you and to meet with the business community and academic leaders throughout the Hudson Valley. Before I start, though, I want to give a thank you. I want to thank five organizations that assisted us with our recent survey of small businesses finances. Now, the five organizations are the Ulster County Chamber of Commerce, Community Capital Resources of Hudson Valley, the Dutchess County Regional Chamber of Commerce, the Dutchess County Economic Development Corporation, and the Orange County Chamber of Commerce. We had more than 100 businesses responded from the Mid-Hudson region to our survey, and these survey results are going to be published early this summer. It's very important for us to get information from the region so we actually understand what's happening on the ground. We're here for Main Street, not for Wall Street, and so that's why we're visiting and why we do these surveys. Each visit that I make to this region gives me a chance, I think, to deepen the bank's relationship with the people who I represent as head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Last summer, I traveled through Central and Western New York on a similar tour, meeting with community leaders, business people, academics, bankers, and government officials. And similarly, on this visit, I'm going to do more of the same. What I want to do is hear firsthand from people here about the economic and financial issues and challenges that people face in the Hudson Valley, so I can best represent all my constituents when I do my work at the Federal Reserve. I want to thank the Center for Research Regional Education Outreach for inviting me here to speak today at SUNY New Paltz. I'm going to focus on economic conditions in the country and in the region, and pay particular attention to how the recession has affected the labor market here. And of course, as always, what I have to say reflects my own views and not necessarily those of the Federal Open Market Committee, which is what the committee that sets monetary policy, or the Federal Reserve System. So we already had a summary of what the New York Fed is and what we do, so I'll go through this pretty quickly. As mentioned, the New York Federal Reserve System was started in 1913, so we're approaching our centennial. With the Federal Reserve Act, the Congress delegated to the Federal Reserve the constitutional authority to manage the supply of money in the nation's economy. Now, the Federal Reserve System is a pretty complicated animal. It has a Board of Governors in Washington. It's a federal agency currently headed by Chairman Ben Bernanke. Plus, there's 12 Federal Reserve banks throughout the country. Now, in our district, as mentioned, has an unusual coverage. We have the 12 northern counties of New Jersey, all of New York State, Fairfield County, Connecticut, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. I haven't been to the Virgin Islands yet, but maybe someday. Each Reserve Bank is district with its own charter and board of directors that are drawn from people in the district, and each bank is overseen by the Board of Governors. Now, the law that created the Federal Reserve made the central bank independent so that policymakers could make decisions about monetary policy, in other words, about what level of interest rates to choose in the national interest, somewhat insulated from political pressure. However, the Fed is accountable to Congress. Congress has set an explicit objective for monetary policy for the Fed to follow, to pursue the highest level of employment consistent with price stability. This objective is also often referred to as the dual mandate because it combines two goals, high employment and stable inflation. In order to promote these objectives, we also pay close attention to financial stability, because as we've seen, without financial stability, it's very hard to achieve our goals for jobs and inflation. So we have the Federal Open Market Committee of the Board of Governors, which meets in Washington 8 times a year. It consists of the 7 members of the Board of Governors plus the 12 district bank presidents. We meet there 8 times a year to vote and deliberate on monetary, in other words, what interest rates to set and when to change those interest rates. As president of the New York Federal Reserve, I'm the vice chair at those meetings. What happens at those meetings, if we have a go-around where each
member presents his or her current outlook for the economy. And as part of that assessment, we augment the information that we get from our research departments with information we get from trips like this, where we travel to the region, and from conversations that we have with our boards of directors, our regional advisory councils, conversations with local shareholders. So this trip today to New Paltz is an important part of, you know, what I take when I go to Washington as part of those meetings. Now, one thing that makes my job a little bit more interesting than others is that New York has some very important and unique roles within the Federal Reserve System. For example, the New York Fed is the reserve bank that's responsible for actually implementing monetary policy. So Washington decides what the interest rate should be, but it's up to the New York Fed to make it so, in fact. That means that the direction of the Federal Open Market Committee, we buy and sell Treasury securities in order to adjust short-term interest rates. We're also the eyes and ears of the Federal Reserve on Wall Street, and we supervise some of the largest financial institutions in the country and in the world. We also operate FedWire on behalf of the Federal Reserve. FedWire is a system for making large dollar payments between financial institutions. We also provide a lot of services to the U.S. Treasury. For example, we conduct all the U.S. Treasury auctions when they actually issue debt. And we provide a lot of services to central banks and governments around the world. Now, at a regional level, we spend a lot of time trying to track economic conditions in our district, and we use a large number of tools that we've created for that purpose. For example, to fill a void in the current measures of economic output, my staff produces indexes of economic activity, which track output for New York State and New York City on a monthly basis. We've also initiated a consumer credit panel so we can monitor local credit conditions. And we've begun a quarterly survey of small businesses' finances to track the issues related to credit and financing for this key job-generating sector. If you're not already part of this survey, we invite you to give a business card to our staff over here, and we will add you to our survey universe so that we can reflect your views in this survey. To share the information that we gather and produce about our diverse district, we have created a website which has a lot of information in terms of local data and maps on conditions within the region. So I invite you to visit this web to explore the very highly detailed information we have on small businesses, credit, and housing conditions in New York Federal Reserve District. Finally, and crucially, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, we are spending quite a bit of our time working with our colleagues in Washington and other agencies in the United States and abroad to put the nation's financial system on a sounder footing. As regulators, we have made some progress, for instance, in crafting tougher capital rules for the biggest banks, but much more remains to be done, and we are determined to keep at it. I recognize fully that there can be no return to pre-crisis business as usual, whether on the part of the financial sector or on the part of regulators like ourselves. We must learn from the economic catastrophe of the past few years so that the financial system is able to perform its essential role in supporting economic activity without being a source of instability for the economy as a whole. So as you can see, all in all, there's plenty to keep my colleagues and me busy, even in normal times. So what do I do now is to turn to looking at the national economy and ask a simple question. What's the outlook and risk with respect to economic activity, employment, and inflation in the nation? Well, since the recession ended in 2009, the economy has expanded, but at a relatively modest pace. Economic growth in the first quarter of 2011, for example, was softer than anticipated, with the initial reading on real gross domestic product, or GDP, that's the economic output for the economy as a whole, increasing at only a 1.8% annual rate. A number of factors contributed to the slowdown in GDP in the first quarter from what had happened in prior quarters. Construction activity fell, likely reflecting the continued large supply of uncontrolled homes. And government expenditures at federal, state, and local levels declined. In addition, real consumer spending growth, that is the spending of households on goods and services, adjusted for price increases in the first quarter, was slower in the first quarter than the last quarter of 2010. This occurred in large part because of the rise in gasoline and food prices that pushed up consumer price inflation last quarter. And those increases in gasoline and food prices reduced the amount of income that households had available to buy other things. This is a pattern that unfortunately has continued to be evident in retail sales in April. Higher energy prices have also contributed to weaker consumer confidence, which also may have negatively impacted consumer spending. However, we're hopeful that the weakness of real output in the first quarter will prove temporary. Although manufacturing production fell in April, largely because of supply disruptions associated with the earthquake in Japan, other indicators, including the New York Fed's own manufacturing, Empire State Manufacturing Survey, generally point to continued economic growth. And it's important to recognize that financial conditions have continued to improve, albeit gradually. And the temporary reduction in payroll taxes and other fiscal measures at the federal level are providing support to demand. In addition, demand abroad, particularly in Asia, remains robust, and that's supporting our exports. Most importantly, and I think the most optimistic sign that we've seen recently, is that the labor market has shown further improvement, as demonstrated by the latest employment report. Although payroll job growth has been too subdued during much of this recovery, the latest figures show the economy added 244,000 jobs in April and an average of 233,000 jobs per month over the past 3 months. While the unemployment rate, which is based on a separate survey, moved a bit higher last month, private sector job growth has been strong and has been strong enough to more than offset government job layoffs, especially at the state and local level. A particularly encouraging sign in terms of the labor market is the fact that we've actually seen fairly rapid growth of manufacturing jobs over the past year. We're also seeing a broadening strength in terms of services employment. While the exact pace of a job recovery is always hard to predict, we are expecting the pace of job growth to pick up further over the first half. And I am hopeful that job growth will continue to strengthen in coming months. We would welcome this. Even if the economy were to add 300,000 jobs per month from now on, we would still likely have considerable labor market slack at the end of 2012. Now, despite these clearly encouraging signs, there are still some downside risks to growth that I think we are watching, so let me list them for you. As I mentioned earlier, higher oil prices and commodity prices have cut into household purchasing power. This is a difficult situation for many families. That could constrain spending more than I anticipate. Second, the renewed decline in home prices could dampen consumer spending and housing activity more than I expect. And third, and we're seeing this here in the Mid-Hudson Valley, aggressive near-term spending constraints are crimping economic growth. Now, in terms of the fiscal constraint at the federal level, I think it's important to emphasize that we do need a credible plan for medium-term fiscal consolidation. That's sort of required and would have economic benefits, but in the near term, fiscal consolidation can negatively impact economic growth. Now, in terms of these three issues, I think they all bear watching, but I think that they remain risks rather than likely outcomes that are going to really hurt the economic recovery unduly. Now, turning to inflation, after a period in which inflation has generally been below levels that the Fed judges to be most consistent with its objectives, on a year-over-year basis, the overall consumer price index has increased more than 3%, which is somewhat above the level that we seek over the longer run. The rise in commodity prices over the past year, in fact, will probably push headline inflation up further over the next few months. But it's noteworthy that even with the sharp rise in oil and food prices over the past year, there has been a very limited pass-through of these price increases into the prices of other goods and services. In fact, most measures of underlying inflation trends, such as core inflation, which excludes food and energy prices, actually remain below levels consistent with our mandate for low and stable inflation. Now, going forward, the good news is that future markets do not signal that investors expect the rapid ongoing increases in commodity prices to continue from current levels. Futures markets expect prices to level off and decline. So if the future markets are correct and prices stabilize or even retreat from current levels, this implies that the headline inflation is likely to move back to a more reasonable level. While this process plays out, however, I think it's important for the Federal Reserve that we keep our eyes closely anchored on inflation expectations, make sure that inflation expectations do not become unmoored. It's much harder to keep inflation in check if people begin to raise their expectations about future inflation. But at this point, the good news is that measures of inflation expectations do remain stable. Economists at the New York Fed have examined inflation expectations using a unique survey that we sponsor. And as we reported in a recent post on our new Liberty Street economic blog, which I refer you to, they find no evidence to suggest that a wage price spiral is getting underway. Well, the good news is good in the fact that inflation expectations are well anchored, but we will continue to monitor expectations for medium-term inflation very closely. So to sum up, in terms of economic conditions at the national level, they have improved over the past year, yet the recovery remains moderate, and we still have a considerable ways to go to meet the Fed's dual mandate of full employment and price stability. So how is this region doing? How is our region doing? As some of you may know, the New York Fed produces indices of coincidence economic indicators to help monitor the performance of this region. And based on these measures, the downturn in economic activity in New York ended in November of 2009. And since then, activity in New York State and New York City has been recovering steadily, but at a moderate pace. So let me turn specifically to employment trends in the region. In particular, I want to describe what the region's experience has been during the recession and since then during the recovery. Now, nationally, during the Great Recession, which began in December 2007, which was the deepest economic downturn since World War II, employment fell sharply, bottoming out finally in February 2010, about 7 months after the official end of the recession. During that period, the country lost almost 6.5% of its jobs, of total jobs, and the unemployment rate more than doubled. Many people lost their jobs or saw their hours and income cut, and the duration of unemployment for jobless workers climbed to an all-time record. For many families, this distress was compounded by the losses of wealth created by declining home prices. Now, since that low point in terms of employment, job creation has resumed, but at a lower pace than we would like, and unemployment has fallen a bit, but not as much as we desire. As in other parts of the country, unemployment in our region did decline substantially during the recession. But various parts of our region have very different experiences in terms of what's happened since that time during recovery. Now, employment in New York State, including the Hudson Valley, declined by less than what happened in the nation as a whole. As I mentioned, the nation employment declined by 6.5%. For New York State and the Hudson Valley, the decline was 3.8% in terms of peak and trough job loss. Part of the reason for the more moderate declines in jobs in New York and this region during the recession was that we had less pronounced housing cycle boom and bust. Indeed, as a percentage, the city and state lost fewer jobs during this recession than they actually did during either of the prior two recessions. So in terms of this particular recession, job losses were less severe than what we saw during the prior two downturns. Now, the good news is, as is true for the nation, the labor market recovery has begun across much of our region. Over the past year, New York State has added roughly 100,000 private sector jobs. But within the state, the recovery has been somewhat uneven. New York City has been gaining jobs for more than a year now at roughly the same pace as the nation, while to date, the Hudson Valley has seen little overall job growth. So let me drill down a little bit more further geographically and talk about conditions here in the Mid-Hudson Valley. So by Mid-Hudson Valley, I'm referring to Dutchess and Orange counties, which comprise Poughkeepsie, Newburgh, and Middletown, the metropolitan areas, and Ulster County, which is focused on the Kingston metropolitan area. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about what the Mid-Hudson Valley looks like from an economic standpoint. Well, the first thing is to note that there's a lot of economic activity going on here. All told, there's 850,000 people reside here and 420,000 jobs located here. And over the past decade, this has been a pretty vibrant region where there's been more people added here than for the state as a whole. People here on average are more educated than for the nation as a whole, as measured by the fact that over 30% of the residents in this region have college degrees. So it's not surprising that median household income in all three counties is above the nation average. The composition of employment varies quite a bit as we go from county to county. Ulster County employs a relatively large number of people in hotels and resorts, reflecting the importance of tourism for the county. And SUNY New Paltz is obviously an important employer in the county. Dutchess County jobs are more heavily weighted towards high-tech manufacturing with growing diversification. In Orange County, transportation accounts for a relatively large share of employment, and that's due to Stewart Airport. You also have West Point Military Academy as a major employer. You also have many Orange County residents who commute to New York City, Westchester County, and Rockland Counties for work. So how has the area fared during the recent recession recovery? Well, I'm going to try to answer that from three perspectives: housing, credit congestion, and jobs. So unlike the central and western New York, this region did actually have a little bit of a housing boom and bust. During the boom period from 2000 to 2006, home prices more than doubled in the Poughkeepsie area and increased by as much as 150% around Kingston. That exceeded the average rise that we saw in the U.S. of about 90% and the average rise of about 50% throughout the near Federal Reserve District. Now, the price declines from 2007 to 2009 were somewhat less severe than for the country as a whole. Prices have fallen by about 20% in this region compared to about 30% nationally. And recently, and this is a hopeful sign, prices in both areas have tended to steady. So how are families in the Hudson Valley doing in terms of restoring their finances? Well, during the recession, all across the country, debt delinquencies soared, and many families found that they needed to reduce their debts to more sustainable levels. We keep track of credit conditions in the second district, including the average debt that people in the area carry, and whether they're current with their payments, by using a Federal Reserve Bank of New York consumer credit panel. So we basically can track how much debt people have per person and how that evolves over time. Now, in terms of the Hudson Valley, debt per person for those people who have credit reports is down by 5% from its peak level in 2008. And as of the first quarter of this year, debt was continuing to decline modestly. At the same time, delinquency rates continue to climb. The proportion of debt that's at least 90 days past due has risen from 2% in 2005, which was actually very low, to 9% currently, which really matches the delinquency rate for debt statewide. These patterns suggest that households in the area are making some progress in restoring their balance sheets, but they have not completed the process, that their balance sheets are still under considerable strain. Now, with regard to jobs, employment losses in the area during the 2008-2009 downturn were steeper than most areas in New York State. The first quarter of 2011, as I mentioned earlier, Hudson Valley has yet to see a clear upturn in terms of employment. The private sector is doing okay. They've seen brisk job gains in leisure and the hospitality sector, and professional business services sector added jobs in Poughkeepsie, Newburgh, Middletown, metro area. Private sector employment has still held steady in the Kingston area over the past year. Both areas have seen continuing job losses, however, in retail trade, and especially in terms of government employment. State and local government employment has declined by about 3.5 percentage points over the past year. And that's really the primary factor that's weighing down on job growth in both areas. Unemployment rates in the Mid-Hudson Valley peaked at 8.4% in late 2009. That's well below the national peak of over 10% and moderately below the statewide peak of 8.9%. Nevertheless, as is true in much of the region of the nation, jobless rates have not retreated much, and thus far remain stubbornly high. Thus, the area was clearly severely affected by the recession. The only good news in this was it was somewhat less severely affected than the rest of the country. The recovery has begun, but there's still some clear signs of distress remaining in the housing, credit, and labor markets. In the near term, the regional economy, indeed the economy of the entire state, faces a number of challenges. Among them is the need to address the large state budget deficit. New York State is not alone in having seen its tax revenue decline as the economy weakened, and it thus is facing some hard choices. As I mentioned, state and local government employment has weakened in many areas. And going forward, further contraction in this sector continues to pose some risk to recovery. Longer term, I think one of the key challenges for this region is to ensure that it trains and attracts a highly skilled workforce that can meet the needs of an innovative and rapidly changing firms. A nation's human capital, a region's human capital, that's the skills and educations of its workforce, determines in large part its economic success and resilience. The education research taking place in local colleges and universities such as SUNY New Paltz here, I think is very, very important in terms of building those skills and sustaining economic growth over the medium and longer term. So in conclusion, let me sum up. The national economy experienced a soft patch during the first quarter of this year, while the recovery in much of this region continued at a reasonable pace. In the region, the continued expansion of employment across the nation should be helpful here in the Hudson Valley, but this region is suffering from the fact that state and local government employment is going to be a drag for a while longer. And I must emphasize that both nationally and regionally, unemployment remains unacceptably high. So I want to thank you all for your kind attention, and I'm going to be very happy to answer some questions.
According to Bloomberg, 7 December edition, 26 million Americans are unemployed or underemployed, with approximately 260,000 new hires per month. That's going to take 10 years to fully employ anyone who wants to work. I represent two organizations of professionals, some 1,200 members, that are looking for work. Could you please identify two programs that directly come out of the Fed that will help the unemployed or underemployed? Could you identify one that is successful, one that isn't successful, and what are you going to do to try to fix that? Thank you.
Well, I think you've highlighted a very key issue that's troubling everyone, which is high level unemployment rate in this region and throughout the state and in the country as a whole. And we try to do that within a number of different ways. First of all, obviously, monetary policy in the U.S. is designed to stimulate economic activity and generate more employment growth. We're in a period of exceptionally low short-term rates, and we're in the process of completing a large-scale asset purchase program designed to ease financial market conditions. So monetary policy is really doing its part. In terms of other programs that the U.S. That the Federal Reserve is involved with, we do a lot of community outreach in terms of trying to provide higher quality economic information to businesses about what's going on in their region so they can plan better and make appropriate choices. In terms of whether to invest and hire. We do a lot of work in terms of financial literacy so that people can make better decisions about how to manage their finances in a prudent fashion over time. We have a number of programs that are designed outreach to community development groups in terms of working to provide affordable housing in depressed areas of the region. So, there's sort of two sets of programs. There's sort of the macro set in terms of monetary policy, but there's a lot of micro sets. Now, I think in terms of which is working the best and which is working the less well, I refer you to the staff that's over here that works directly on those issues. I think they could answer that well. But we're always fine-tuning what we do and trying to learn in terms of what works well and what doesn't work so well and try to make our programs more effective.
Is there a census among your peers on what businesses are looking for to start investing in the economy at the rate to sustain the kind of job growth we need in the real economy? And if there's more than one answer, would you mind prioritizing them?
I mean, I think there's a number of key issues in terms of business willingness to hire. One is, you know, confidence on the economic outlook. So, you know, you have to recognize that this is all sort of tied up together. In other words, if you get more employment growth, you get more household spending, that makes businesses more confident about hiring and investing. That hiring and investing in turn then generates more hiring. So I think you have to understand that it's all sort of tied up together. So, you know, our job at the Federal Reserve is to provide a hospitable environment in terms of monitoring the financial market conditions to get that engine started. And I think the good news that we've seen over the last few months is we are actually starting to see signs that that positive dynamic is taking place. In terms of more job growth, that leads to supporting more spending. And as that happens, we would expect business confidence will continue to improve, and that will lead to more business hiring and investment. The second thing that can be done is obviously good government policy. It's on a whole variety of areas, so that businesses can feel comfortable if they have, you know, some sort of certainty about not only what the environment's like today, but how the environment likely to evolve in the future. And, you know, one, I think, you know, factor that probably was a little bit of a inhibited business activity over the last couple of years was uncertainty about what was going to happen in terms of, you know, regulatory reform. Now we know what we're doing in terms of regulatory reform, that effort's in process. And so I think what you're seeing now is bankers sort of know what, you know, how they're going to, what the rules of the road are going to be going forward. And so you're starting to see an easing of credit conditions, which also I think is very, very important to businesses. Businesses need credit to be able to invest. And so we're starting to see an easing of credit availability. So I think that's also very, very important.
I'm from Highland High School, and we're all seniors. So we're just wondering what the Federal Reserve is doing to create availability for students.
Well, we have lots of power. They do not extend quite that broadly. In terms of student loans, obviously that's a decision for, you know, the federal government, for New York State, in terms of what kind of programs that they want to have in place. You know, that's a decision for them to make. Obviously, as I said in my remarks, I think education is very important. Improving the quality of human capital is very important. And obviously, you know, affordability is very much a part of that.
I would like to ask if you could please comment on the decline of the dollar recently and what impact that has on inflation and employment and on
all
of the dollar.
Well, as some of you may know, the Fed never speaks about the dollar because that's really the province of the Secretary of Treasury, my former colleague, Timothy Geithner. So I think I'm going to leave it to him to talk about the dollar. All I'll say is, you know, the dollar fluctuates, and you know, if you look at where the dollar is today, it's not very different than where we were at the eve of the financial crisis. But you'll have to direct your question to the guy.
We'll bring him in shortly. First, thank you very much for coming and speaking. The essential nature of your comments, I think, are going to sink in as the day progresses. I'll be driving along thinking about some of the things you're saying and the impact of them. One comment that you made, and the young woman in the back started to address it as well, is that education and the training of a workforce is truly one undeniable economic engine. And her question was, what are you doing to encourage student loans? And of course, you appropriately answered that's not your province. But what is the New York Fed doing to encourage the marketplace to invest in education and workforce training?
Well, I think it's, you know, important to recognize that, you know, monetary policy broad as opposed to specific, and we don't engage in monetary policy and actions that sort of determine the flow of, you know, credit to particular sectors or regions. That's really a province of the fiscal authorities, so New York State Legislature and Governor and in Washington D.C. What we do, I think, is underscore at every opportunity that we can the importance of education and human capital in terms of creating rising standards of living, higher productivity growth, and a more stable and productive economic activity. So we sort of use the bully pulpit to make the clear the importance of education and improving human capital to make sure the U.S. stays competitive. But in terms of the tools that we have in our toolkit, we don't really have anything that specifically address the availability of credit for student loans per se.
I teach in the economics department at the course that we've been having a rather robust debate about monetary policy in my intermediate macro class, and my students have, you know, some of whom I hear, they have questions about the effectiveness of monetary policy, particularly quantitative easing too. How successful has it been? My students are concerned that we still seeing bank reluctance to lend, particularly to small businesses. Leading financial firms doing beautifully, but there's been an asymmetry in terms of recovery. So that's one question. Dealing with this asymmetry in recovery in terms of those who are high skilled versus those who are low skilled. So that's one issue. And embedded in that is a debate that we've been having in the classroom about the effectiveness of quantitative easing, particularly when we are not anymore in a liquidity trap, but close to a zero-bound interest rate. So is that, and we know what happens, right? When we're in a liquidity trap, monetary policy is ineffective. And so what we're, and something that you might not want to address, but I would love for you to address, is then the importance of fiscal policy.
Let's take an opportunity to take that one question first in light of limited time. Thank you.
The purpose of this program is basically to take low-risk assets out of the hands of the private sector, encourage the private sector to buy other assets, and thereby make financial conditions, so stock prices up, credit spreads narrower, to thereby stimulate the economy. Now, the reason why we did this was because short-term interest rates are almost at zero. And so our ability to make monetary policy more stimulative by lowering short-term rates was unavailable. So we were basically looking around for means to make monetary policy more stimulative by other means. And so we engaged in this large-scale asset purchase program in response. We always thought that it was not going to be a panacea. We thought that it would be modestly helpful in making financial conditions more accommodative, and I think it has. Since we started to contemplate the program, the markets started to anticipate that we're going to move forward with this program. The stock market has moved up considerably, credit spreads have narrowed, credit availability has improved. So I think the bottom line is that it's been helpful in giving the economy a little bit more momentum. But we never really expected it would be that powerful because it's a blunt instrument, and monetary policy, there are limits to the power of monetary policy, especially coming out of the kind of financial crisis in terms of what we found ourselves. We think it did more good than harm. We're happy that we conducted the program. We think it's one reason why we're seeing a little bit more in the way of job growth today than we were last summer.
President Dudley, thank you for coming today. My question is about inflation, and when you spoke earlier about inflation, you observed that pass-through from commodity prices has not shown up that much in other consumer prices. It seems to me that that's a really key issue in determining future or looking ahead at future expectations of inflation. Has your staff identified any reasons why we haven't seen a pass-through, and why we might continue not to see a pass-through? Because we don't see commodity prices falling.
The question is, why have we seen so little pass-through of higher gasoline prices and food prices into other prices of goods and services? Well, the first reason is that there never usually is very much pass-through. So the fact that we're not seeing that much pass-through this time is not actually unusual. It's actually quite typical. For example, when you think about oil prices are used mainly for gasoline and for driving. And so it doesn't really get into the prices of many other things because it's really just used for that one thing. Now, food prices obviously get into more things, and things like cotton and other commodity prices can get into the cost of apparel. But generally, the pass-through is pretty mild. One reason why it might be particularly mild right now is the fact that we're also seeing, because of the weakness in the labor market, very little in the way of wage gains. So you know, think about the costs that businesses face. The predominant costs that businesses face are not commodity prices, but wages. So with wages, wage gains being very subdued, which is tough on the households clearly, it makes it very hard to get a real significant ongoing inflation.
President Dolan, thank you for being here. Looking at the situation in Washington where the government is debating what to do on raising their level of deficits, is this something that must be reined in, because otherwise we're going to eventually be seeing inflation? And inflation, I believe, is the one thing that can destroy the security of people who have worked their entire lives to gain that security. I mean, you can have your assets, but if you see them eroded, it's permanent loss to you. And then also, how can New York State rein in its spending without and still retain our jobs so that we can keep people working and yet not have the exorbitant overspending?
First of all, let me address your question. You're asking a question about the federal budget deficits. Obviously, something needs to be done about that over the medium or long term. We're not on a sustainable path. But we say that on inflation, that's our job, the Federal Reserve's job. And regardless of what Washington does in terms of the federal budget deficit, we're going to do our job in keeping inflation in check. So yes, if the federal budget deficits were to persist, that would make our job harder. And obviously, it's not sustainable over the long run. At some point, investors and U.S. Treasuries will start to balk. But regardless of what happens in Washington on the federal budget, we're going to do our job in terms of keeping inflation in check. So there's absolutely no question in my mind about that. Now, your second question was?
The state of New York.
Well, you know, look, I think it's, you know, fiscal consolidation is always painful and difficult, and it's always leads to tough choices, you know, in terms of the composition, in terms of how much you rely on taxes versus how much you rely on spending. And I don't think that we should say that it's a free lunch. It's not. You know, sometimes you have to do things that are unpleasant but are necessary. And I think getting both the national fiscal house in order and the state fiscal house in order is something that we're going to have to do. And try to do it in a wise way that does the least damage to the region and the country on an ongoing basis in terms of job creation and competitiveness.
Your opening comments, you spoke about how the energy costs penalize the overall economy. And what would a national energy policy where we required at least 50% of our own crude needs to be produced within our own borders, and also a policy to extend that 100% of our crude needs could be met in the Western Hemisphere? How would that help you with that, the monetary policy and improve our economy?
I think you're leading the witness. questions about energy. The U.S. is quite dependent on foreign imported oil, and obviously that means that we're a little bit at the risk of political developments outside the United States. As we've seen in recent months, political instability in the Middle East and North Africa has contributed to constraints on the supply of oil, and that's probably the primary reason why oil prices have been going up. And I think, you know, the tenor of your question is correct, that obviously to the extent that we could reduce our dependence on foreign oil, we would have a little bit more control of our destiny. So I think obviously steps that can prudently be taken to make ourselves less dependent on foreign imported oil, especially from regions that are politically unstable, you know, something I would be happy to see occur, because it obviously make my job a lot easier and make the country less vulnerable to events that happen elsewhere that are outside our control.
The gentleman in the black shirt,
sorry, crowd.
There's been various congressmen, like Ron Paul, that have been very vocal about this. He's been saying that he would want to reinstate the gold standard. What is your opinion? I don't exactly agree with it, but to control inflation.
I ask a question with a question. What do you think of my opinion? Look, I think the Federal Reserve is essential to maintaining price stability in this country. I think we've done a very good job on, in terms of keeping inflation in check. We're determined to make sure that we achieve our dual mandate over time. Obviously, we're having a difficult time right now in terms of generating the kind of job growth we want. But over the long run, we're going to keep inflation under control. And I think we're going to do it in a way that's a lot more effective than a gold standard could be. You know, gold standard, if you actually have a gold standard, what happens is that the price level in the economy goes up or down depending on whether you find or don't find gold. So you're basically spending a lot of economic resources to dig gold out of the ground. And on top of that, you're actually subject to the economy to the whims of whether people find gold or don't find gold over the medium to longer term. So I am not in favor of returning to the gold standard.
And we can take two more questions.
You mentioned that you talked about regulation. David Stockton, former budget director, was writing about casino capitalism and some of the blame the Fed a lot in the last 10 years of kind of contributing.
Supervision, and I think we could have been done a better job in terms of putting more emphasis on financial stability as a concern, because without financial stability, as we've seen, can't have an effective monetary policy in an economy that operates close to full employment. So you know, we are trying to learn from our mistakes. Now, in terms of what we're doing going forward, there's a whole host of initiatives underway, ranging from higher capital standards and liquidity requirements for commercial banks to regulating the over-the-counter derivatives market much more closely. To taking a look at compensation practices among large financial institutions to make sure that those compensation practices are consistent with safety and soundness. I'd be here quite a while if I listed all the initiatives that are in place. But I think the most important thing is not only that are we doing a lot, I think that in terms of what we see as our core mission, financial stability, we get it. Financial stability is just as important as monetary policy in terms of our core mission. And we're going to make sure that we keep our eye on that ball going forward. And we're going to, we're going to keep our eye on what happens in the financial markets and among the financial institutions so we don't have a repeat of what happened during the last decade. We're here for Main Street, not for Wall Street. And we have to make sure that Wall Street doesn't misbehave in a way that threatens Main Street.
You spoke earlier of the banks regaining their confidence because now they know where they're going. But it's obviously their job to understand monetary policy. How are you trying to improve consumer confidence?
Well, I think there's limits to what we can do directly in terms of consumer confidence, except one, come to places like this and sort of explain why we do what we're doing, why we're doing it, and how we see things. And hopefully, after these conversations, they'll sort of understand us a little bit better, and we'll be more effective in terms of how we communicate, which will make people a little bit more confident that the Federal Reserve is on your side and trying to do the right things to generate sustainable economic recovery. So I think that's what we can do. The second thing we can do is follow a set of monetary policies that actually helps stimulate economic recovery and a convalescence among banks and households in terms of their balance sheets. And I think what the good news is that convalescence process is well underway. If you look at the banking sector, they've raised lots of capital, so they're much better capitalized now than they were a few years ago. And so as a consequence of that, as they replenish their capital, we start to see that lending conditions are starting to improve again. We do a survey of bank loan officers to ask them, are you tightening credit or are you loosening credit? And as we went through the financial crisis, month after month, they were tightening credit. And that was obviously having a terrible effect on the economy in terms of the ability of households and businesses credit to finance their activity. The good news is that's now starting to move in the opposite direction. Credit conditions are improving. The terms on which banks are extending credit is actually easing. It's not back to where we probably will get to over the long run, but the convalescent process is definitely well underway at this point.
I want to thank President Devlin very much for his presentation and for visiting with us. I regret that we don't have more time, but I'm obligated to keep him on his schedule. I'm reminded, and not by him, but by others. I want to express my gratitude for all who came, especially members of the business community, students, and colleagues at the university who came to this event. I'm grateful for the supportive turnout, and I think it's been a productive opportunity for all. Thank you very much.